how lucky it is just to like get through a day without pain.
If you look at me, it doesn't appear that I have a disability.
A test that comes back abnormal. It's like, yes, we're onto something here.
Welcome to the season 4 premiere of the Major Pain Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Mercury, and every week on this show, I interview people living with chronic illness and disability. My goal on this show is to spread empathy and awareness and build community around topics that are often experienced in isolation. I am thrilled to be kicking off the 4th year of Major Pain. I can't believe it. And as we do at the beginning of every year, this week I'll be catching up with previous guests of the podcast. Each person that comes on this show and shares their story is just giving us a snapshot of their lives, a piece of their story. It's impossible in an hour-long podcast to get the full picture of what someone has lived through with chronic illness or disability. And I always find it extremely illuminating to bring people back on the show and hear updates to their story since they last spoke with us. In this episode, we'll be catching up with 3 previous guests. First, we'll hear from Michelle, who first appeared on the podcast in an episode titled Living with POTS, Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome, that was published on December 1st, 2021. Then we'll hear from Becca, who first appeared on January 4th, 2023, in an episode titled Becca's Chronic Illness Was Misdiagnosed as Anxiety for Years. And finally, we'll hear from Simon, who first appeared on November 9th, 2022, in an episode titled Simon's Silver Bullet for Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. Michelle and Becca both have new diagnoses since first appearing on the show. And for both of them, this new information is recontextualizing their journey and providing new avenues of relief from their symptoms. And when we hear from Simon today, we'll be throwing around a word we don't hear often on Major Pain, the C word, cured. Simon is feeling cured from his chronic illness. So we have good news all around on our updates this year. We never shy away from sharing the harsh realities of living with health challenges on this podcast, but we also never shy away from celebrating success stories, and I'm thrilled to be sharing 3 of those with you today. Can't wait to get to those updates. We'll get to it in just a few minutes. I have a bit of an update myself that I wanted to share with you as we kick off this episode today. Last year was a huge year for me. I got diagnosed with small fiber neuropathy and mast cell activation syndrome, the medication for which has completely changed my life. My functionality has improved, my mobility has improved, my brain has improved, all of it has been so exciting. But as I've shared many times, I was not able to get positive testing for mast cell activation. I did get positive testing for small fiber neuropathy, but the mast cell activation diagnosis is our best guess based off of the information that we have and my results to the medication. The testing for MCAS is not super reliable. It can be really difficult to capture a positive test result, so my doctors have been advising me to not worry about that because the medication's working, so just keep pushing forward. But there is a sort of baked-in problem with that in that I don't have proof. A huge part of my story and my history with chronic illness is doctors not believing me. Going into doctors, describing my symptoms, them testing me, not seeing anything wrong on the tests, and deciding that this illness was all in my head. I used to feel like I was alone in that I was the only person in the world going through that. And then I started this podcast and found out that it is one of the most common experiences living with chronic illness, especially with a mysterious chronic illness. And I have gotten so much comfort from that, from finding out that I'm not alone in that. But I actually just had an experience last week with a doctor that I had been seeing for years, my gastroenterologist, where I discovered that he doesn't believe me about my diagnosis. He didn't believe either of my diagnoses. I had an appointment with him and everything went well. I didn't have any reason to be concerned. But as I've learned from hosting this show, you always have to check your after-visit notes because you never know what your doctors are writing about you unless you check. I got an after-visit summary from my appointment and I read it, and it was shockingly different from what we talked about in my appointment. This doctor mentioned that I, as the patient, believed that I had small fiber neuropathy and mast cell activation, but he couldn't find evidence for either of those diagnoses in my notes, and he was unsure why I was being treated for mast cell activation. He went on to say that he believed my symptoms may be functional and that he would recommend a referral to psychiatry. I was simultaneously absolutely stunned by this and also not at all surprised. It's happened to me so many times, and it hasn't happened in years now. It's been at several years since I switched over to the University of Washington Medical Center. I've had such incredible care. I have amazing, empathetic doctors who understand that test results are not the end-all be-all in diagnosis, and that medical science is limited, especially when it comes to a relatively new disease like mast cell activation syndrome. So my MCAS doctors, my primary care, most of my specialists that I see, they're all willing to admit that, hey, if this medication is helping you and we can see the benefit that it is providing for you, then they're willing to trust my reports about my body and how these medications have helped. But still, I have a doctor who doesn't believe me, and it is so crushing. It is so painful to see that in my notes. I actually wrote to the doctor right away and said, if you had felt this way, you should have brought this up during the appointment. Because I have such a long history of going through psychological evaluations to prove that I have a disease. I went through this cycle for years where I would exhaust all the possibilities with all of my specialists. They'd send me to get a behavioral psychology evaluation. The behavioral psychologist would say, hey, you have a medical problem. You need to go back to the doctor. And then I'd go back to the doctor and say, well, we have no ideas. And then I'd start over with new doctors. That was my cycle for years. So I have a bunch of behavioral evaluations on my chart. And I would have shared all this with my gastroenterologist if he had given me the opportunity. And also, I have a positive test result for small fiber neuropathy. He couldn't find it in my chart. So then he writes in my chart that I am believing something that doesn't appear to be real. I sent him those test results and he was at least repentant on that front, but otherwise completely unapologetic and said that he actually has a responsibility to put those thoughts that he has about my care in his notes. So I don't think there's anything I can do about that. If anyone knows differently, please tell me. This letter I got from my gastroenterologist also came on a particularly bad day because I know that I don't have hard proof of the MCAS. And my new MCAS doctor and I were discussing this, and she's amazing. I love my MCAS doctor. She's so great. My original doctor has moved to another hospital, and someone that he trained is now my new MCAS doctor, and she's fantastic. I'm so thrilled to be seeing her. And she and I were discussing the fact that we don't have the proof and that that is frustrating. You know, there's this lingering doubt in the back of my mind. And also, I shared with her my history with doctors doubting me and that I'd love to have proof. Little did I know that it was about to happen again. So we decided to rerun all of my MCAS labs, and I chose to go off of my medication to do so, which was rough. I got very sick. It was actually rough in a way that I didn't expect, which is a long story. I actually shared that story on the latest episode of the bonus podcast on Patreon, so I won't go into all the details right now. But I will tell you that the day that I was doing this 24-hour urine collection to retest my MCAS labs was the day that I woke up to have this letter from this doctor not believing me. And then I just felt all this pressure for those labs to come back positive, to show MCAS, to give me that definitive proof. And very, very frustratingly, that did not happen. I got all the test results and they're all within normal ranges. But even before running these tests, my doctor told me, hey, we're not going to change your protocol even if these tests come back normal because we know the protocol is working. So nothing is changing. You know, after a lifelong search for a diagnosis, even having a clinical diagnosis has been so incredibly valuable to me. It is terrifying to not have that final piece of evidence that would really take it over the finish line and make it incontrovertible, which I would just be so thrilled to have. But that might not be the reality of my situation ever. I might never get that. I do have that for small fiber neuropathy, which is great. And of course, there's always going to be a piece in the back of my mind thinking, is there some other disease triggering my mast cells to flare, causing this small fiber neuropathy? And I will keep that door open. I think for someone like me, I think that it is important to keep that door open. Medical science is ever evolving. It's based off of evidence. We take the evidence that we have and we make the best choices that we can for our bodies. But new evidence could always come to light and change things. So I'm staying open to that. I'm going to talk to my MCAS doctor about it, say, are there any other rocks we should look underneath? And if we continue to find nothing else, then we just assume we have the right diagnosis and I just move forward. But then I have to stay in a constant state of sharpening my self-advocacy skills because I will always face doctors with this rigid, narrow view of complex diagnostic situations who are more likely to blame the patient for their symptoms than actually try to uncover the cause. Which is so frustrating, especially because this gastroenterologist told me that he's completely unfamiliar with MCAS, that he doesn't know anything about it. So even if he hadn't left these notes and made me want to switch doctors, I would have switched doctors anyway because he doesn't know how to help me for the thing that we believe that I have. Which makes it even more upsetting that he still felt the need to insert his opinions about my mental health into my chart. But yeah, I mean, this whole experience was just a huge reminder of all of the trauma that I've experienced. It brought a lot of these feelings back to the surface of not being believed, not being trusted about what I'm reporting about my own body, people assuming that I was drug-seeking or attention-seeking. And I know that we all live through that. We all deal with it. And it's part of why I wanted to share this story is because we're all in this together. We're all in the same boat. We can help each other. We can support each other. I have learned so many things about how to advocate for myself from listening to other people's stories on this podcast. And it's one of the many, many reasons that I'm so grateful for the community that we've built and so excited to be kicking off the fourth season of the show. So let's check in with our community. Let's see what people are saying about the podcast. We got a new comment on Spotify on one of our very first episodes with my friend Brandon discussing Charcot-Marie-Tooth, a genetic condition that he lives with that is a form of muscular dystrophy. This comment is from Vicky, and it says, "Enjoyed this as I also have CMT and can relate. My brace is less cumbersome than a whole calf brace, and it really helps my gait and prevents frequency of falls. It's called an XOL, so check it out." Vicky, thank you so much for your comment. Brandon was discussing his bracing situation for mobility, so this is a great tip. Vicky, great to hear from you. Thank you for your comment. I also got an email about our last episode with Kate about miserable malalignment syndrome. This is from Tatiana, and it reads, "I just listened to Kate's interview, and it's been very helpful to me. I've been suffering from miserable malalignment syndrome for years, and I had three surgeries, labrum and FAI, on both hips, two arthroscopic surgeries on the right hip and one on the left hip, as Kate had. I am a former athlete as well. I really want to find out the name of the surgeon who is treating her so I can have a chance to stop the joint pain and the struggle I've been through since 2014. I am wishing Kate to have a fast recovery and best outcome to all the surgical procedures. She is such a strong person and has become my motivation and given me the strength to never stop believing that I will get better. Congratulations on your podcast. It changes people's lives. Sincerely, Tatiana." I'm happy to report that I was able to connect Tatiana with Kate to share the information about her surgeon. I'm always so thrilled to make connections like that. If you ever have any questions for our guests, not just for me, you can always reach out to me, majorpainpodcast@gmail.com, and I will pass those requests along. Tatiana, thank you so much for reaching out. I really appreciate hearing from you. I'm so grateful to say that we've had a bunch of new ratings and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We're up to 46 five-star ratings on Spotify and 41 ratings on Apple Podcasts, including this brand new review from Emma Eileen that reads, "Enjoying this so much. Found this podcast during a time in my life where I really needed it. Jesse, you are such an incredible, relatable host. You really have a gift for connecting with people and providing a space for folks to tell their stories. A big thanks to you and all the guests for sharing your stories and helping us know we are not alone." Wow, Emma, thank you so much. I'm actually getting a little teary-eyed reading this comment. I really appreciate it so much. All of these ratings and reviews are so, so massively helpful to help the show to reach new listeners. I cannot thank you all enough. So obviously, I've really been feeling the support for the show. It means so much to me. We had some new signups on Rare Patient Voice, which is also so exciting. This is a really cool program that I'm thrilled to be involved with. Rare Patient Voice helps to connect patients and caregivers with research studies and surveys where you can be paid for your time to participate, an average of $120 per hour. If you sign up using our affiliate link, rarepatientvoice.com/majorpainpodcast, then you'll be supporting this show while you sign up. As I mentioned earlier, we just released a brand new bonus episode for our Patreon subscribers. Once a month, Andy and I sit down to discuss what's going on in our lives behind the scenes. Last month, we shared our epic engagement story, which was so fun. This month, we talked about our trip to Albion with my family, and I share the whole story of my epic cheat day where I retested all of my MCAS mediators and ate high histamine foods while off my meds. It was a free-for-all. And we talk a little bit about our current obsession, which is Love Island US Season 5. Oh my God, so good. Patreon is an incredible way to support the creation of this podcast directly with monthly financial contributions, where you will receive monthly bonus episodes and gifts when you sign up. Extra special thank you to our Patreon producers supporting this show at the highest tier of $25 per month, Steve Kavanaugh, Chris Fowler, Trish O'Brien, and Hipster Leia. Each and every person supporting the show on Patreon is helping to keep this show alive. I appreciate it so, so much, and I would love your support moving forward into season four. This is a great time to sign up on Patreon. You can learn more at patreon.com/majorpainpodcast. Other great ways to support the show include, of course, leaving us positive ratings and reviews wherever you get your podcasts. You can send in a donation on PayPal with the email address majorpainpodcast@gmail.com, or you can click one of the affiliate links in the show notes of every episode. We've already discussed Rare Patient Voice, but there's also NeuroHealth, an online neurology and headache clinic, or our Amazon shop where I have set up a list of all of the supplements that I use for mast cell activation syndrome. Moving into a new season of the show always gives me the opportunity to cut together a new opening montage that will start every episode for the entire season. This is something I really enjoy doing, which is, you know, having a little bit of a different flavor at the very beginning of the podcast for each season. So as you heard in the opening moments of today's show, we do have new clips over the opening montage. First, you'll hear the voice of Andy, my fiance. But, you know, her story has been a through line of this podcast. She's done several episodes, not just about her story, but also talking with me about my story and the interaction of being in a relationship with someone who lives with a chronic illness. So it felt very fitting to include Andy in the opening montage. Then you'll hear Daniel from his incredible episode about schizophrenia. And lastly, Isabel, who shared her complicated health journey with us involving POTS, small fiber neuropathy, and potential other mysteries. Thanks again to those three for sharing their stories with us, and their voices will now be with us throughout season four. I'll remind you as always that my guests and I are not medical professionals. Please do not take any medical action based off what you hear on this podcast without first consulting your doctor. And with that, I'm so excited. It's time to catch up with previous guests of Major Pain, Michelle, Becca, and Simon. Michelle, welcome back to the podcast.
So excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you again. We just took a look and you were first on the show December of 2021. So
that's right.
It's been a little bit over 2 years. I'm so excited to catch up and see how you've been.
Yes. I was just saying that you had reached out to me because we follow each other on Instagram and you'd seen that I was in the hospital recently. I posted a little like Happy New Year's pic from like NYU Langone. It was so crazy when you reached out because I had just gotten a new diagnosis and it just felt like a full circle moment again. But basically, over the last 2 years, I got my POTS diagnosis when I turned 30, which was a huge kind of watershed moment for me. And I was having some increasing digestive issues in that time. And one of the big issues that I come up against with POTS is that I have this constant like cost-benefit analysis going on in my head of like, is this a POTS issue that if I went to a bunch of specialists for, they would just end up telling me it's POTS and I'll have wasted a bunch of time and money? Or is this an actual other issue that I need to address that can be, you know, because POTS is incurable. So that can be addressed like with medication or other management things. Or is this something where I'm just going to waste the limited energy that I have and I need for my job and like come up with nothing? And because POTS is one of those conditions that has a kind of, you know, a lot of things fall under the umbrella of what it is, digestive issues is one of the main symptoms. And so I was kind of writing it off for a long time as like just general POTS stuff. And then about 6 months ago, it started getting progressively worse. I remember I went to high tea with my cousins. And I had a response to that that I usually only have to alcohol, which is I can't sleep that night. And it was just like tea and crumpets. And I was like, that's weird. Is this a gluten thing? Because I know that gluten is a trigger for POTS. Like, should I start really trying to cut that out?
And it started getting kind of progressively worse. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to try gluten-free. I'll try cutting out caffeine, which is a known trigger for POTS. I'll try cutting down sugar, which is a known trigger for POTS. And was really trying to pin down what the issue was. And I thought I was getting better, but I wasn't. And I got progressively worse to the point where I forget how graphic I can be on this.
You know what? As graphic as you want.
You know, I feel like people with conditions like ours have just like been through everything, understand everything, and are, you know, there with you. So basically, every couple weeks, I would be pooping blood. And it was getting worse. And then mid-December, I was like, oh, I definitely have salmonella. Like, cannot leave the house. Every 30 minutes, I'm in the bathroom. There's blood every time. Like, this is really bad. It must be salmonella because, you know, I guarantee there's cross-contamination happening somewhere. And I look up salmonella, you know, if you're still experiencing symptoms after 5 days, you should go to the hospital. You know, 9 days in, I'm like, maybe I should, maybe I need to go in because I can't go to work anymore. I go to CityMD and they're like, you should definitely go to the ER. And I go to a gastroenterologist and they're like, you should definitely go to the ER. And so I finally go to the ER and they admit me almost immediately, as quickly as ERs do. And they're like, you're staying overnight. Like, we're not letting you go. And initially they thought I had sepsis, and it's possible that I did have sepsis in addition to what was going on. Because like my body was just shot. My like C reactive protein marker, which is the standard marker for inflammation in the body, which is usually supposed to be between 0 and 5, was 232. So,
whoa,
obscenely high, like disturbingly high. So they admitted me. They did CT scans and x-rays and a colonoscopy and an endoscopy. That's the great thing about being admitted. They can just do everything. You don't have to, you know, you're just being dealt with. Your whole body is being constantly monitored. And pretty much as soon as they did the colonoscopy, they were like, we are pretty sure this is ulcerative colitis. Obviously, this is another like diagnosis that's years and years in the making, because it's, again, one of those things that I think I've had for a really long time, especially because there's periods of flares and remission. And I've been through, you know, multi-month long periods of multi-year, sometimes long periods of very severe digestive issues. But it seemed like a very quick diagnosis to me. Again, yeah, I guess I just wanted to talk about it because, first of all, it's treatable, which is very different from POTS, obviously. Basically, now every 2 months, I go in for an immunosuppressant IV drip. Ulcerative colitis, I'll explain, is essentially an autoimmune condition. They don't know why your body does it, but your body attacks your colon. Very unfortunate. And so the medication basically allows your body to like calm down your immune system a little bit. It does make you more susceptible to things like colds or COVID, but the difference that it made immediately upon getting treatment, like I have twice the amount of energy that I've had in my entire life. I initially thought that POTS was like my main diagnosis, but I think it's definitely like ulcerative colitis was like the main like untreated big drain on my energy.
Wow.
My joint pain is gone. My stomach pain is gone. It's just made a world of difference in my life. I'm like, I can cook my meals. I can clean the house, like basic things that healthy people can do on a regular basis are like possible for me now. I didn't think that I would be able to have a kid before. And now I'm like, it may be possible now. Like that's like the level of difference. So it's made basically in like a week period, because I ended up staying for about 8 days, my life changed completely. And yeah, the difference in, you know, having a treatable condition, and also the difference in like the amount of response I get, or like the doctor's responses to it, were also very different. Because when I got my POTS diagnosis, because it's a much less understood condition, they were kind of like, you have it. And then I went home and it was crickets. And I was like, I guess I'm going to be figuring out exactly what this means for me and how I'm going to manage it and like how my life is going to be. Whereas with this condition, it was like, first of all, I had a team of doctors that were all giving me like incredible amounts of information. And then when I went home, it was like I was getting calls, like people were setting up appointments for me, like people were giving me treatment plans, like they were talking about, like, you know, worst case scenario, best case scenario, like totally, absolutely different experience, which of course is very disheartening, knowing the other side of it and knowing like how like isolating it can be, just being like, I guess I have to read all the scientific articles and like decipher them and, you know, be my own doctor essentially. And then, you know, going to doctors and them never knowing what the condition is and having to explain it to them, as opposed to, again, this where it's like, everyone knows what it is. It's like a medication has been used for it for like 40 years, like highly known, highly understood. It's been kind of a whirlwind again since the last time I spoke to you of new stuff in my life. And new ways of kind of dealing with my body and understanding my body. But definitely, again, feeling very positive and grateful that, you know, with my POTS diagnosis, for example, they basically put me on a steroid initially for all of the inflammation. And they would have taken a person without POTS off of it pretty, like, just like stopped the medication. But because they know I have POTS and there can be heart-related issues with stopping steroids, like, cold turkey, they knew to taper it off really slowly. So there's definitely benefits to knowing all of these things. But yeah, it's just, it's been a really interesting couple of months.
Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. I'm thrilled to hear that getting another diagnosis is a positive thing in your life, that this is making such a big difference. And I'm really interested and want to hear a little more about this crossover between ulcerative colitis and POTS for your personal experience. You thought that it was just POTS kind of keeping you down, but then getting this other diagnosis, getting on the medication for ulcerative colitis, your energy's up, your pain level is down. So what are the symptoms that you were attributing to POTS that are now better that you're treating ulcerative colitis?
Yes, I'm always positive about a diagnosis because it always means more answers. I know that different people have different approaches to this. And, you know, we think that my niece might have POTS because, you know, we know that my dad has it. It's hereditary in my family. And, you know, her family's reaction to that is very different than my reaction to that. Because I know, like, if I had known when I was a little girl, it would have made a difference. But yes, so the interactions, I know, it's crazy. It's just, it's so frustrating when you have like a blanket diagnosis with no known treatment. And I was doing some treatment. I was going to tell you, I was trying out vagus nerve stimulation. I don't know if you've heard of this.
Yeah.
There have been like a lot of really good studies showing that it can, that people with POTS have like either smaller vagus nerves or vagus nerves that aren't stimulated as much. And so I was trying vagus nerve stimulation. So I was trying a bunch of things. But essentially, you know, I've just never had a normal poop in my life. That's just a fact. Like, I think maybe like one every 2 months is like pretty good. And like, that was my standard. And, you know, I would have these periods where I would just have insane bloating, like, and just, you know, need to rush to the bathroom, need to always be in the vicinity of a bathroom. And that obviously really limits you in terms of what you are capable of doing in public in a city like New York, where, you know, the bathrooms will be locked. So yeah, just having to be in the vicinity of the bathroom, not having regular bowel movements, definitely stomach pain. And it's like, it's so hard to describe what a base level of pain feels like to someone who doesn't experience pain on a daily basis, because it's like, it is a fog and a haze. Like, the difference in my mood when I don't have this just like general pain is so crazy. You're just able to be a happier and more positive person.
These were all things that you thought were just side effects of POTS.
Right.
Wow.
Because ultimately, like, blood flow and oxygen like flow to your body is like a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And the joint pain as well. Like, I had gone to a joint specialist, and again, a very frustrating visit where he was kind of writing me off and was like, yeah, that I haven't ever heard of someone every 6 months not being able to walk. Sorry. And it's like, okay, well, I'm so glad I came up here. Very frustrating as usual. But yeah, joint pain again, I thought, you know, it makes sense that if there's a blood flow issue, like people with sickle cell anemia have joint pain, that would be POTS related. So mostly, yeah, the stomach pain and definitely the energy. It's like when you're in pain all the time, that is a huge draw for your energy. And I guess I hadn't realized how significant it had gotten. I knew that my health was worse, but I don't know maybe if I was in denial about how bad it was, or if I had just like come because I thought it was part of POTS, and because I know that POTS doesn't have a cure, I was just like, this is my life. And so there's no point in mourning not having enough energy to do all the things that I want to do. So yeah, I guess those are the things that I was kind of associating with POTS. And it's just hard because it's one of those umbrella diagnoses and they don't really know how it works.
Yeah.
There's a lot of theories about how it works, but because of that, they can't kind of narrow down exactly what it is and how and why it functions the way it does.
So now that this medication has lifted this huge burden, all of these symptoms that you just described are getting better on the ulcerative colitis medication. What is the remainder of your POTS experience? I very vividly remember you telling me about, you know, having to be horizontal all the time to get that blood flow to the brain. And, you know, your initial episode about POTS is, you know, one of the great episodes in our catalog of episodes. You did such a great job explaining how POTS works and what it feels like. What is the residual effect of POTS that you're now still living with?
So I definitely, like, all of the things about POTS that I described are definitely still a part of it. I think it's just that it's not as severe, to be honest. I don't feel as faint as often. I think, you know, getting one thing sorted out in your body kind of helps the other issues. So I do still have to be horizontal. I do still have to cross my arms and legs. I still have to, you know, move around on the train platform and make sure that I'm not standing still. I still eat a high sodium diet. It's actually funny, but during a flare, I have to eat a high sodium diet and a low fiber diet. So pretty much the worst possible diet for a regular person is like where when I'm like feeling low, I'm like, all right, I know what's up. So still eating a high sodium diet, that really helps. Still staying hydrated, that really helps. I still get migraines for sure, not as frequent. So it's all the same kind of stuff. It's just definitely, I think, less pain than I thought was associated with it. And I guess fewer digestive issues than I thought was associated, at least for me. It may be that during a flare, it could still cause those things, but they were constant, they were severe, and they were debilitating to, I guess, the point that they were their own thing. So yes. And I still have brain fog, obviously.
Yeah, it's really interesting that if the load that your body is carrying is lightened, then the other chronic illness is improving. So that's really exciting. And, you know, POTS is so variable. Like, from one day to the next, the symptom picture might look very different. So it does make a lot of sense that if you can address this one issue that is really weighing you down more than you even knew, because you didn't know you had a second chronic illness, that the first one would improve a little bit. So that's really exciting to hear. And also, I'm so excited to hear that you're now thinking about starting a family and all of these life options are opening up in a way that you never could have expected before getting this new diagnosis.
Yes. I mean, basically, as soon as I got home, I was in the kitchen. Cooking has always been a passion of mine, but it essentially, you know, when my health started getting really bad, it's just, I could not do it. And I had to, you know, get convenience foods and frozen foods and all of those things. But at my core, from, you know, my childhood, I learned how to cook from Food Network because neither of my parents cooked. And I was obsessed with cookbooks and getting into the nitty gritty and pickling and bread and all of those things. And they all just kind of fell by the wayside. And basically, as soon as I got home from the hospital, I was like, okay, it's time to do some really weird stuff in the kitchen. Let's make vinegar. Let's like do some weird stuff. And that's been really great. And I, you know, the kid thing, I'm like, I'm the kind of person where I don't need to have kids. If I'm in a position where things seem right and, you know, the the stars align, I'll feel good about it. But it was just like, I remember, you know, when my health was really bad, just being like, I can't clean up after myself. And if I can't clean up after myself, I can't clean up after another human being. And I don't want to put a kid in that position. Basically, as soon as I started the medication, it just felt like I could start my life. Like, I had just been on this pause for years in this like no man's land of survival and like triage of my life, just trying to make enough money to not be homeless and to like eat enough food to not die and all of those things. And like my cognition got better. I felt like in the hospital, my cognition getting better because I'd gotten to a point where my body like wasn't absorbing nutrients. So like my brain wasn't working at full capacity. Like my body wasn't working at full capacity. So to have the option of being able to do way more stuff, like not necessarily in the vicinity of a bathroom. And, you know, to have that extra, something extra at the end of the day, which to me is a signal that there could be, you know, someone else there that I could care for, is a huge deal. I mean, it's just unbelievable that this happened, you know, while I was still in my childbearing years, as they say. Yeah, it's really, it's a really positive moment for me. Because you want to make the most out of your life, however much that you have to use, you know, and I just feel so grateful and lucky that I got a diagnosis at all.
Yeah. Well, I'm thrilled for you. I'm so excited to share a positive update. Dealing with chronic illness, you know, sometimes things get worse, sometimes things get better, and it's always a roller coaster, and you never know which way it's going to go. But every time I get to catch up with someone and hear that they've made improvements, brings me a lot of joy. I'm so excited to include you in our season 4 premiere and to hear your amazing updates. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Of course, it was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
Becca, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to catch up. Good to see you again. I understand you're going by Beck these days instead of Becca.
I am.
Awesome. So, Beck, welcome back to the show. Okay, let's remind our listeners about your last appearance. So, you first appeared on the show on January 4th, 2023, a little over a year ago, in an episode called Becca's Chronic Illness Was Misdiagnosed as Anxiety for Years. And something that really stuck out to me from your episode was you were having these very severe symptoms. You were having seizures, neurological symptoms, and your doctor said it was the worst case of anxiety they'd ever seen, and it prevented you from getting care for years. You were diagnosed by a neurologist with functional neurological disorder, a neurologist who was not really interested in digging deeper and trying to figure out what your underlying cause was. Then you got to a new doctor who diagnosed you with CFS/ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis, and POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. But at the time that we last chatted, you were really feeling like there is an underlying condition. My doctors have not really been willing to look into it, and my care has really been kind of halted in its tracks by this anxiety diagnosis. And I know you were still battling against that at the time. So what's the update? What's happened since then?
Well, exciting news. I am officially diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Wow. Congratulations.
So that's awesome.
So it's so funny to congratulate someone on having a disease, but congratulations. Right. I think that that feels appropriate.
It is good. It's done a lot of good for me. I had first seen a rheumatologist who had done the initial diagnosis, and then I finally got to see Ian Wallace that we were speaking about last time, and he had kind of, I guess, double confirmed it. And I also have a variant of unknown significance, I believe, for the same gene that causes classical Ehlers-Danlos. So that's interesting, and we're going to keep an eye on that.
Wow. So were you diagnosed with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome?
Yes, that's where it's going to be until we know further information about that variant.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially because HEDS is the only form that does not currently have a genetic defect attached to it. Not to say that there isn't one, but that just the research has not pinpointed it yet. So for you to have a variant of unknown significance on the classical EDS gene is really suspicious and very much, you know, would lend huge credence to this diagnosis, because there is stuff we still don't know. You have all these symptoms. You having a connective tissue disorder would make a lot of sense. So, you know, we've covered EDS several times on the show, but it's been a little while. So can you remind us, what is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome?
So Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, it's a connective tissue disease, and it's a genetic condition. So you're born with it. With hypermobile type and classical type, most types, I believe, also have like lax joints, and that's due to issues with the collagen. With hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, it's faulty collagen. I don't really know where they stand with it, whether it's just the collagen isn't being made correctly or if there's like not enough. I'm not really sure where they're at with that. But it's kind of a multisystematic condition. So it ends up causing people with EDS a lot of other comorbidities. Typically, I think that the comorbidities are often more severe than the diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome itself. If somebody had like hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and that's all they had and it didn't cause them any comorbidities, which I feel like would be pretty uncommon, I don't feel like it would be as damaging or prevalent in the sense of a disability. There's a lot of joint pain and damage and dislocations that can come from it, which can be managed. But I think the comorbidities can definitely like wreak havoc on people.
Yeah, and you'd already been diagnosed with POTS, which is a very common comorbidity of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So, I mean, this really just reshapes your entire journey, reshapes your entire story, to know that you've had a genetic condition since birth that is affecting your connective tissue, that is sort of wreaking havoc in your body, causing comorbidities. POTS is the first one we know of. Are there more that you have confirmed?
Yes, actually. So now that they know that I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, it's been incredibly helpful. Because now when I go to a specialist regarding symptoms, they look more at the comorbidities that are common with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome instead of just being confused. And when I had gone back to the gastro doctor, I had kind of re-brought up the symptoms, the gastro symptoms that I was having. And I then had an Ehlers-Danlos diagnosis, and the first thing she said was, let's check for gastroparesis, because a lot of people have gastroparesis. And I was like, oh no, I probably don't have it. And I do. So, unfortunately have that. We did the gastric emptying study, where you eat like radioactive breakfast and then they take images of your stomach. And I am very close to being severe. So I learned that. I learned that I had mast cell activation syndrome. They did all the testing for that. Feeling a lot better on treatment. So that's great.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's wow. This is a lot of new information. Oh my God. So gastroparesis is partial or sometimes even near complete paralysis of the gastrointestinal tract. So you eat things and they just get stuck. They aren't moving. So a lot of people have to, you know, go on feeding tubes for that. How has that impacted your day-to-day life? What is the status of your gastroparesis? Are you still able to eat solid food?
So currently I'm still eating solid food. I do have flare days where I'll eat liquids or eat nothing. So I feel like I'm kind of in the luckier category for how severe I am diagnostically. I so far have been able to avoid medication. I was almost put on Reglan, and I just have heard such bad things with black box side effects. It can cause like tardive dyskinesia, and I really didn't want to risk like another medical problem. Yeah. And so
sorry to interrupt. What is I don't even know this word you just said. Tardative dyskinesia? I'm sure that's wrong. What was that word?
So tardative dyskinesia, it's dyskinesia. A condition that can be caused by medication. I don't know if it can be caused outside of that. It's a neurological condition where people have, it's almost like Tourette's-like movements. So they can have like chronic lip smacking where they can't control their muscles, or some people have like really chronic like just constant like movements with their body that they can't control. It's very spastic, like their muscles are like constantly spasming. I've seen it happen to people with psychiatric medications, like especially for schizophrenia. And so when I had seen that for Reglan, I didn't find it to be worth that trouble.
Yeah, for sure.
And unfortunately, who I'm seeing for my gastroparesis is she's not a specialist in it. And so she doesn't really know what to do past that. So I'm just currently looking for a specialist to really help me with it before it starts getting worse, because she did tell me that more than likely it will progress from the point that it's at.
Yeah, but if you can get on treatment and try to get all of these different disparate things caused by one overarching condition, if you can start to get some of this under control, you know, now's the time to do it for sure. We got, and also you said mast cell activation syndrome, which now we're disease twins, because that's my big diagnosis last year. But you said you did the testing and it came out positive, because that's so rare. I mean, I still have not tested positive, even though the medication is wildly successful. So we're like, yeah, this has to be the right thing. Tell me about your testing.
Yeah, so I cannot remember specifically what they test for, and some of them I can't even pronounce, but I had seen a really lovely doctor over here. You may have heard of him, Dr. Armitano. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I haven't heard of him.
He works with the Neurological Board Associates of Washington. He specializes in POTS, but he sees a lot of comorbid cases of that kind of trio, like EDS, POTS, MCAS. Yeah. And I was telling him some of my symptoms that I thought were related to POTS. And he was like, oh, I don't think so. And he did this like scratch test where he took a little piece of metal and scratched it on my skin to see how it reacted, like the histamines in my skin. And I had tested positive for that. And so he had sent like a 24-hour urine test and blood testing, and he preferred that I went and did it on a flare day of my symptoms, but so many of my symptoms overlap that I didn't know what would have been considered MCAS
for sure.
And so I just went on a random day. My levels of everything were just so significantly high that he was like, there's no doubt that you have it. Everything was like tripled, like the amounts that they should have been. Wow. And that was like a good day for me. So I don't even know what it would look like on a bad day. And so I started treatment pretty immediately. And it's definitely impacted my health for the better.
What is your treatment plan so far?
So at the moment, I'm doing the Pepcid with the Zyrtec, which has just been wonderful. And then I started oral crumulin, I believe is how you pronounce that.
Yeah.
And I wish I did it more regularly, because it's amazing for the gastrointestinal effects of MCAS. I just can't stay on top of it as much with the gastroparesis, which is a little hard. It's hard to intake so much fluid for me. But when I'm able to, I do that. And then I have the albuterol inhaler, because it turns out that asthma that I was talking about in our last episode was actually asthma from MCAS. And so I am using fluticasone, which is a similar to albuterol, which is like it's in an inhaler and you take it like once a day to keep your lungs from being inflamed. And they wanted to put me on, I believe it was Singulair as well, but I didn't really want to risk some of the psychiatric effects that came along with it.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty happy with where I'm at the moment.
Amazing. Wow. What are the symptoms that have changed for you that you now attribute to the MCAS?
Yeah, so I started to not have as many seizures. I have two different types of seizures. I had convulsive seizures, which were covered under my epileptic medication since 2018. So I don't really have them anymore. But I had these stare-off seizures that are similar to my mom's. And with my epilepsy, it's not coming up on tests, but I'm diagnosed with it because my mom is also diagnosed with epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So it's more of like a clinical diagnosis. But with the other seizures that I have that aren't being controlled by the epileptic medication, it was kind of a mystery. So they were calling them psychogenic seizures for a while, which kind of is what rooted that functional neurologic disorder diagnosis that I used to have.
Yeah.
When I started the MCAS treatment, I stopped having as many of those kind of stare-off seizures. And I was told by one of my specialists that MCAS can cause seizure activity or seizure-like activity that's not actually epileptic. Wow. It's not super solid in science yet. I don't think they've done a lot of studies on it, but it's seen pretty frequently in MCAS patients. So I thought that was super interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you're the first person I've heard talk about this. And I had a lot of seizure-like things happening to me that haven't really been happening since getting on meds also. So this actually really rings true with my experience. It was like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it was, I would, you know, kind of get stuck and shake. And I would never black out or anything, but it would feel like a wave was crashing over my brain and I couldn't like do anything. And yeah. I went through an EEG and it was normal while I was having some of these like shaking episodes. So I've always known I didn't have epilepsy, and we've always just kind of attributed it to, you know, part of my mystery. And I've had a lot of neurological symptoms that we think can be attributed to MCAS. And it's so interesting because it's like, you'd never expect that type of thing to then be helped by going to an allergist, you know?
Yeah, I never thought that ever.
Yeah, totally. And that, I mean, this is a lot of stuff. Is this the full list of comorbidities that they've discovered?
I am sure that they have discovered more. I've kind of gotten to a point where it just kind of goes over my head because they've diagnosed me with so many things that when they do diagnose something else, I'm like, that's new.
I'm getting the impression that your quality of life has skyrocketed and you're just kind of like, I'm good. You know, I have all these medicines. I mean, this is a lot to get used to. It's a lot to integrate into your daily life. Just for me, just MCAS, I've been working on that for over a year. And I'm still trying to figure it out. You know, it's a lot to try to deal with. You know, are you doing the low histamine diet as well?
I am not. My body is so picky about what I eat in general that I just kind of, I'm just happy my body will eat. So I just allow it to eat what it wants to, essentially.
Totally. So I'm sort of like intuitive eating.
Essentially, because most days I'm not eating much. And then when I am able to eat, I just eat because those days I feel like I'm starving. I wanted to try that for sure.
Well, I would say maybe don't because, my doctor, when they put me on Cromolyn, it was like, okay, we're going to get on Cromolyn. We're going to get on, you know, all the H1, H2 antihistamines, like you were mentioning, Pepcid, Zyrtec. That's H1, H2. For me, I take Allegra and Pepcid, which is, you know, fexofenadine for my H1. And then they wanted me to go off of the low histamine diet. And I tried, but for me, eating histamine is like one of the worst parts of it. It's something that's like, I get really sick if I eat histamine, even on all the meds. So I've not been able to go off the diet. But if it sounds like maybe that's not the case for you, you have so much else going on in your gastrointestinal tract. It sounds like getting any food in is hugely important. And if you're not noticing a huge flare-up after eating, I wouldn't even mess with the low histamine diet. It's so restrictive. And, you know, once you go on a diet like that, it can be hard to get off and be healthy. So, you know, everyone's body is different. It really sounds like the expression of this disease in your body is very different. It's mixed in with all these comorbidities. you have a connective tissue disease that I don't have. Everything's different for you. So, you know, I think for anyone who's really suffering with MCAS, the low histamine diet is a must. But it, with the amount of benefit that you're seeing and the amount of improvement that you're seeing, you know, maybe skip it. Of course, I'm not a doctor. I shouldn't give anyone medical advice. This is just like, I wish I didn't have to eat this diet, you know?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. When I first looked up the histamine diet, the first thought in my head was, oh my gosh, I feel so bad for the people doing this diet. This is rough. I'm so sorry you had to do that.
Well, but I mean, you know, I, as far as I know, I don't have gastroparesis, and that is not fun either. So,
no.
Okay. Your whole energy feels different to me from the last time we spoke. I just get the sense that this has just been the ultimate validation for you. Someone who really, really suffered, not just from being sick, but even more so from the treatment that you received. You know, the stories that you told about doctors just being so insistent that you had anxiety that they would literally not look into anything else. And now we know you have a genetic connective tissue disease. And we even have, you know, genetic testing, which a lot of people with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos get diagnosed without genetic testing. And you even have genetic testing showing an even extra piece of evidence. Not to say that those other diagnoses are not valid. Just to say, like, I know what it's like personally to be diagnosed with something that I have not tested positive for. And that's frustrating. You know, you've gone the extra mile. You've tested positive for everything. You had so much validation. And I get the sense that it's really changed how you feel about life and yourself. Is that true?
Yeah, it really is true. It was actually something that I was thinking on this morning. I was looking back at actually some old photos of myself and just how miserable I looked compared to like current photos. And I was like, oh my gosh, like not even just physically, but mentally, I was exhausted, just horribly exhausted. And a lot of that was constantly fighting people trying to tell them that something was going on and never being believed. And that's such a hard battle to fight. And there are a lot of days where I just wanted to give up, and I didn't. And I'm glad that I didn't, because I am at like a really good point in my life. I just got a job recently, which is great. I don't think I would have without the information I have now, because I wouldn't know how to accommodate for myself. And I got into a relationship with my girlfriend as of November of last year, which is a beautiful and loving relationship. And I never had that previously, because I don't think I was capable of respecting myself the way I do now. And I think that is also due to being diagnosed and being able to validate myself. It was really hard for me to think that I even deserved respect back then, before I had the diagnosis. I think that it changed my life in so many ways that people don't think that it would.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. And I was going to ask about your relationship, because I've seen photos that you've been posting online of you two together, and you just seem like glowing, like you're so happy in this relationship. I'm so happy for you. It's so important to get to a place with chronic illness where we can accept what's happening to our bodies enough that we can bring another person into the mix. And, you know, loving relationships are the number one thing that can get us through. So that's amazing. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
Wow. This is thrilling. This is a thrilling catch up. I'm so happy for you on so many fronts. What's next for you? Are you just sort of in this place where you want to perfect your regimen, your daily routine, as far as living with these new diagnoses is concerned? I mean, because that could take a long time.
Yeah, I guess there's a few things that are next for me. One of the biggest being is self-love. I still do struggle with judgment from other people. Like, I think any disabled person gets, whether that's in public with my mobility aid, like when people see me out with my wheelchair, even though I've been using a wheelchair on and off since 2018, I still get so nervous about it. every single day. And so one of my biggest goals is just being confident and showing up as myself and loving myself for who I am. And then as for medical stuff, there has been some speculation after seeing a long COVID rehab doctor for the ME/CFS that I might either have narcolepsy in combination with the ME/CFS, or I might not have ME/CFS at all. And it might just be narcolepsy with the fatigue of EDS. And so I started some narcolepsy treatment and I'm waiting to go get tested for that. So I'm pretty excited about that because ME is a scary condition, and I will forever support that community regardless of whether I have it or not, but it would be really good news to not have it.
Yeah. Wow. So is narcolepsy testing, is that a sleep study?
Yeah, I believe it's a special kind of sleep study. And I think that I've even had it before because I also did a sleep study for sleep apnea, and I do have sleep apnea. It's another issue I have from my Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. But I don't believe that I tested positive for narcolepsy. So I'm being sent to a movement specialist that's specific for like sleep disorders that are neurological, like narcolepsy.
Wow, fascinating. Well, keep me updated. Let me know what happens with that. I'm very curious. Narcolepsy is not something, I don't think we've covered that on the show really at all. I'm trying to think back. I'm getting to the point where I can't remember everything that we've covered. But yeah, I'm so thrilled to catch up with you. I'm thrilled for you that you have all of these answers and all this validation. And I know that the trauma you experienced when you were young is not something that someone forgets. But I hope that these diagnoses can help you to move forward and to start healing from the trauma that you experienced outside of being sick, just the trauma of the way you were treated. So this is huge, huge, amazing news. Thank you so much for coming back on the show and sharing your updates with us.
Of course. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Simon, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Jesse. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I'm so excited to hear about how you're doing. Your first episode is one of my most memorable episodes for me personally of what we've covered on the podcast.
Thank you.
Your episode came out about a year and a half ago titled Simon's Silver Bullet for Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. And you sort of walked us through your journey into hell and back. And the way that you talked about your illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis, you called it a slow erosion of everything I considered myself to be. And you kind of very vividly talked us through what it was like to have your entire life and your health just evaporate in front of your eyes. And then you found one drug, low-dose naltrexone, and over the course of 5 years, started to get better and better to the point where you were going back to life as normal. Is that a good representation of your story?
It's great. Yeah, I've always, reflecting on our time together, I was really amazed at your ability to, because for me, it's this giant, huge ball. So that's sort of like featureless, you know, it's like it's too big. And so it was such a real gift to talk with you a year and a half ago, because you had an ability to sort of make a certain intelligibility or sort of like make sense of it in a way that I had always struggled to, partially because it's so emotional for me. So, it's hard to kind of get your arms around it. But it's a great summary.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I mean, I've lived something very similar, so I get the journey, you know. And I've done this a lot. We're now over, you know, over 150 Amazing. Episodes, covered over 100 diseases, which I just did the math recently, so I keep saying that because I finally know what the answer is. So we emailed recently and you shared an update with me that I really wanted to share on the podcast because I thought it was so interesting. So how have you been in the last year and a half? What has happened since we last had you on the podcast?
Yeah, so within the last year and a half, I had slowly been having fewer fatigue relapses. It's funny, I'm so distant from my illness that I've actually started to lose all the terminology I used to have around it. So I didn't call it a relapse. I called it something else, but whatever, it doesn't matter.
A flare up,
something like that. Yeah, but anyway, I started to have fewer and fewer of those where I was at pretty much full functionality, but I still could feel certain days I was a little bit, you know, tired here or there, or maybe I didn't have days where I was tired, but I would have, let's say, if I ate too much sugar or if I didn't get enough sleep, let's say 2 or 3 nights, I got 4 hours of sleep per night, I could start to feel kind of that deep CFS fatigue. I would have these instances where it still felt like my disease was sort of in the wings. And then over the last probably year, I started to have almost none of those. And so even if I would get 4 hours of sleep, or even if I would eat a bunch of sugar or whatever, you know, it's so hard to avoid eating sugar on holidays, you know? So eventually I'd always be testing my, because sugar used to really make me have a CFS kind of a fatigue thing. Mm. And so at holidays or whatever special events, you're like, oh, I'll have like a little half piece of cake or whatever. So you're always kind of testing it just by being in the culture. And so anyway, over probably 8 months ago, I said to myself, I have not had a CFS flare up in a long time. I wonder what it would happen if I just went off the drug. And I had heard of friends of mine in the CFS world who just went off LDN, low dose naltrexone, after having not been on it, or after having been on it for a while, but having no CFS symptoms. And they just went off at cold turkey and they were fine. And so I'm so honored and humbled to say, and I say this with all the consciousness of all the chronic illness people out there who are stuck. But I feel really honored and humbled with the fact that I am completely off all drugs and I do not have any CFS symptoms at all. So, you know, insofar as health goes, I'm completely recovered. Except for a few little niggling kind of issues, but
I mean, that's something I just don't hear on the podcast. Yeah. You know, I mean, it gives me chills to hear you say, I'm recovered, I'm off drugs, and, you know, this thing that has haunted your life has sort of disappeared. That's next to unbelievable to me. I'm thrilled for you. And, you know, when you told me that in email that you were off LDN and doing great, it's like, I got to hear about this because that is massive. You know, the purpose of this podcast is not to give people false hope.
Of course.
There's so many podcasts out there that are like, this is how you cure yourself from this thing, and this is how you can find recovery. And that's not what this show is. First of all, I'm not qualified to do that. And also, I really believe that that journey is different for every single person because of our individual biochemistries and so many reasons that I just don't understand. So, you know, this show's not about how do you recover from something? It is, how do you live with it? You know, what is the reality of living with something? And maybe that's why, but I've just never heard a recovery story like yours before on the podcast, you know, because that's not really what we're set up to do. But I'm so thrilled that this has kind of come across my desk, so to speak, that here is someone who has a really horrific chronic illness who is now essentially cured. I mean, I don't like to throw that word around, but does that word feel appropriate to you?
Yeah, it feels appropriate.
Wow.
There's two things that come to mind. Is I will never forget the awareness I gained during my illness of all the people who are stuck in basements and stuck on the couch and have the expectation that this is the rest of their life. So I don't go shouting this from the rooftops, like, you know, whatever you're talking about. And I say this kind of I'm cured kind of thing with a full awareness of that suffering and actually a real deep feeling for those people. And I know this is my story and you talked about that very eloquently last time, but I just want to say, like, it's part of that. It's part of my story is the awareness of all the people out there who don't have as easy of a path as I did. Well, it was such a hard disease. So I don't want to say I had like a But you know what I mean? Like, I'm just so conscious of all these people who don't have, who haven't gotten some sort of silver bullet experience.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate you saying that a lot.
Yeah. And the other thing is really crazy is that I had like a spiritual experience when I got my initial pump of getting cured or getting relief. Like the first initial time I could walk down a sidewalk, it was like the world was just gold and shouting joy. And it was like this, it was bizarre and wonderful. It was like living in a movie. Everything was surreal. And I mean, it was so conspicuous. And moving from being kind of sick and less sick and less sick and less sick to no sickness at all has happened so invisibly in my own experience and consciousness that I almost, it surprises me because I didn't have like this moment where I'm like, I'm off drugs. Like it just felt such a gradual healing, you know, that I feel on some level like it's taken, I don't even have like an experience of getting cured. It wasn't this like zero to hero kind of thing. Yeah. So I did have it at the beginning. The first time I got to walk outside was really remarkable. And I'll never forget that. It was like this very, I think I talked about it last time, this busted up sidewalk next to a pizza shop. You know, it was nothing special, but it was just like so radiant. And now it's just this quiet arrival of goodness, you know?
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I mean, since we last talked, I have gotten answers for myself, right. And I'm now on medication, and I'm experiencing some of what you talked about last time where, you know, I was so sick, barely leaving the house, using a wheelchair because my legs hardly worked. And now I'm, you know, going for jogs and bike rides, and amazing. I'm doing stuff more days a week than I'm not doing stuff. And I'm still like in the middle ground, you know, where I'm having flare-ups all the time. I've had like 2 flare-ups this week so far. The thing that's really triggering me is exercise, which is ridiculously upsetting because it's like the ability to use my body and move my body. I'm just like, I'm so excited. I want to do everything. And then I do something. And it's like, well, now I'm sick for 3 days. Yeah. So I'm still in the middle of it, but I'm only like a year out from being on the medication. I'm on this huge regimen.
Yep.
And I actually started LDN 2 weeks ago. It's been on my mind since I talked to you. And then on the podcast a month or two ago, I talked to Marisa, who has mast cell activation syndrome, which is what I'm being treated for. And she's on LDN. I was like, you know what? I just really need to make this happen. I still didn't know where to get it from, but Marisa gave me a hookup, which is this website called Ageless RX. And this is not, you know, a sponsored discussion at all, but they have a whole regimen of things for people to take for anti-aging, which is obviously not what I'm looking for, but they do prescribe LDN. It's an online pharmacy. So now I have a giant container of 1.5 milligram LDN, and I'm like 2 weeks in. I have had some side effects since starting to take it. Mostly it was kind of disturbing my sleep, and I had to switch from taking it at night to the morning. Is that something you experienced?
No, what it did was made me sleepy, but it didn't disturb sleep. So, but it, crazy thing. I mean, no one knows why it works, and I've never heard a doctor talk about its like mechanism at all. It just, you know, so everybody, it seems like has the effects are different for different people.
Yeah. And it's actually starting to catch on. My doctor is now prescribing it, which I found out after I got some, although it's cheaper from where I'm getting it because it has to go through a compounding pharmacy. And what I asked my doctor about it when I interviewed you, and he didn't know anything about it. But now, a year and a half later, he's prescribing it. And I don't think he even remembered me talking about it. But he's like, oh, I'm so glad you're trying that. I have a bunch of patients doing it. And it's kind of a 50-50 thing. Yeah. Like 50% of the people, it's really helping. So it's helped so many people like you that it's now starting to catch on, which is really exciting.
Yeah, you know, I listened to that episode of you talking about your diagnosis, and I was so moved because the way that you and your partner Andy, the way that you and that Andy said you had gone in the episode and you had forgot to say your major pain, and she's like, "Hey, aren't you forgetting to say something?" And you're like, "Oh yeah, my name's Jesse. My major pain is cell activation." Anyway,
yeah, that's right. Oh my God, yes, I remember that.
Anyway, it was just it was so touching. It was just so beautiful. And you shared this story. If I can, you know, toot your horn here, you shared this story of going to the beach and playing in the water, and it was just reminded me of a lot of the stuff that had happened with me and just the initial recoveries and the joy of being in the world again. So
yeah, totally. Well, because I've had a little taste of this myself now, I have some questions for you about it.
Yeah,
because
please.
That day of like, I'm walking on the sidewalk and the sun is streaming through the leaves and everything is beautiful and incredible. Just that simple, you know, being outside and feeling that connection to the universe and being alive and the incredible nature of that. What of that remains at this point in your life? Because it's been a while. And how long has it been now since, you know, it was 5 years sort of recovering on LDN. How long are we past that? Is it 6.5, 7 years now?
I think I would say that it's been 6 years since I went on LDN. So I've been off for about a year, maybe something to effect.
Yeah.
I have to admit that if I wanted to, I could totally forget about that experience.
Like,
I wish that the lesson that life is beautiful was something that you got to keep and it just is there forever. It's like a level up in a video game. Like you don't level down in Final Fantasy, right? But like the truth is, if I do not stay within a heart space of gratitude, I actually do lose that ability to realize what a gift everything is. So, you know, again, a lot of times people want to like make sense of these horrible illnesses by being like, wow, what an incredible person you're going to be once, you know, the lessons you're going to learn through this and all this kind of stuff. It's like, yes, but there's a big asterisk there, which is that you always have to remain in a place you always have to remember. You have to remember this stuff. And if I don't remain connected to the memory of my illness, I do forget how thankful I am and how beautiful the world is. I do.
I'm smiling as you're saying this because I agree. I think that that is human nature. And I think that that fact that you can forget is such a gift. The fact, even if you're forgetting the important lessons, the things that, you know, your life is completely changed forever. Your outlook is completely changed forever after going through being completely physically disabled. But the fact that you can go back to life and sometimes even forget that that happened to you.
Yeah.
That's part of human nature. And that's a gift, I think.
Yeah.
And I agree that like there's moments where I forget to be grateful that I'm on my feet and I'm only a year out, you know? Yep. And I still have those moments where I'm pinching myself. It's like, I can't believe I'm doing this thing out in the world. But then there's moments where I'm like, I'm so stressed about this thing that I'm doing, and that's all I can focus on. You know, I'm so annoyed by something that someone said, or I watched a news article that made me angry, and I just get kind of grounded in the day-to-day grind, the frustrations of life, and I forget the gratitude. So, you know, but there's a part of me that's thankful that I can even do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do think I think you named one of the main benefits of remembering our suffering is that nothing fazes me. Well, these are all generalizations. I'm a lot less fazed by stress than I used to be. You know, like I started a financial website back in the day to do this thing with this thing. And it was so anxious about it. I was starting something myself. So similar to your podcast, you can sort of always be working on it. So it was this anxiety. It was always worming itself into my mind. And it was a constant struggle. I remember sitting at dinner by myself at a restaurant just to get out. And I would take out, back then you could remove the batteries from your phones. And I would take out the battery from my phone and I'd put my thumb into the battery slot just to reinforce like your phone cannot ring. You cannot, you know, so I could eat a hamburger without thinking about this thing I was starting and the amount of anxiety and stuff. So I will say that one of the main benefits of really having suffered and remembering how hard things were is that everything else just doesn't seem as stressful anymore.
Yeah.
If I remember that space, remember, you know.
Yeah. And I think that space is always accessible. There's moments where I forget to be in it, but then I can check myself.
Yeah.
Or something will remind me because there's reminders everywhere. and that baseline of gratitude will come back. And I do think that that is a permanent thing, and it's going to ebb and flow. And there's times where I can forget because I get distracted. But that gratitude of, I'm learning to do woodworking, you know? Like I'm doing something with my hands and my mind and my body for fun. And I'm getting back into making music again. And these are just things that I just never thought that I would do. And I had accepted letting go of.
Right.
So, it's a very bizarre process to bring things back in your life that you had thought were gone forever. It's really changed my perspective on aging, you know?
And can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So I used to think of life as a straight line where your health is a straight line. You're in your prime. You're in the prime of your life. You have the prime of your health. And then as you get older, it starts to decline. That's how I used to think of it. But I've gone through decline and recovery. So now I recognize that that isn't true, that life ebbs and flows. And there may be a point in my future where my health suffers. But the big difference in my mindset is that I used to think that if things get worse in the future, they'll just continue to get worse.
Right. You know,
that accumulation of damage can never be reversed.
Yeah.
So if I get sick in the future, then I remain sick, you know, and then things just get worse after that. But my perspective now is totally different. Those moments where something changes in your body can be very profound and feel like, oh my God, this is going to be bad forever. But even if it never gets better, that doesn't mean it's going to be bad forever. You will adjust and adapt. Because I adapted to using a wheelchair, and I was prepared to do that for the rest of my life. And I was recognizing that I could be happy in a wheelchair. So the fact that I am now walking again is amazing, but it's also showed me that I can be happy with adaptation and that things aren't a straight line. And sometimes as you get older, you may lose the ability to do something.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's forever necessarily. Or if it is forever, it doesn't mean that you won't find something else that will fill your life in a similar way.
Gotcha.
So nothing is linear.
So you're talking about two different factors. You're talking about the ability to find joy and gratitude within whatever context we're given.
Yes.
And you're also talking about the baseline for your total mobility and power and your agency as a human who can walk around, stand up, go swimming. This sort of ebbs and flows as well. And then it causes us to have to recalibrate or attune ourselves to that new environment for discovering joy and happiness. Is that kind of what I mean?
That's exactly it. You get me. Yeah, it's those two things combined that are so variable. And it could be, you know, as I get older, I start to have some mobility issues that could never go away, and that's okay because I'll adapt. Or I could find out there's a reason for it and adjust whatever it is, and it gets better. And either way, there's no permanence, you know?
Yeah.
Either way, like, things are still ebbing and flowing as I move forward through life. And as long as I can hold on to this sense of gratitude for what I can do, I feel like I'll be okay. So it's, you know, it's really changed how I perceive the world.
It reminds me, and I said this the last time, but I'll just say it again because it's such a stunning, stunning thing, is they've done studies on life satisfaction with people before and after they became quadriplegic.
Mm-hmm.
And after they have a period of adjustment, they have the exact same life satisfaction. So if people work sort of like, I think what the study shows, it doesn't show that like, hey, everyone gets quadriplegic and everyone's great. It's not what it says. It says that the people who were relatively satisfied with life returned to a relative satisfaction, and the people who were dissatisfied with life returned to a relative dissatisfaction. That's
interesting.
Yeah. So it's amazing to me. It's so countercultural, that message.
Yeah. I think it's hard to be happy if you haven't been challenged. I think that if you haven't been challenged, it's really hard to be satisfied or grateful at all. If everything in your life has been handed to you and you're always healthy and you're always happy, then you're going to be miserable, right? Because you don't have a frame of reference for what happiness actually is, and you don't know how to appreciate it, and you'll always be wanting more.
Yeah.
How does your life look different now? Like, what does your life look like now?
I mean, before I got sick, I was a very spirited young man, a young man of 29, let's say. Okay. And like I said last time, I really miss the person that I used to be, because he was in a lot of ways more joyful. That he was kind of invincible in a sense. And I miss that feeling of invincibility, even though I obviously was very, you know, vincible. So, yeah, I mean, in comparison now, I got married and I have two kids. And, you know, last night the kid was up at 12 and at 6:30 a.m. at midnight and 6:30. And so, in some level, I've never been busier. But I am much more, and this is also, I've just become an older person. It's been 10 years since I've been 11 years since I got CFS. So it's hard for me to say what's changed a lot, because it's such a huge span of time. So I think I'm just really busy. I'm a full-time researcher, I research philosophy and theology, and I work with this beautiful family. And, you know, but I'll tell you, like, when the kids are up three times in the middle of the night and everybody's sick because they had some other 3-year-old sneeze on them at one point, now a whole house is sick, and, you know, we're out of groceries, and we have to figure out what to do for dinner with no food in the house, and all the stresses of having young children and of just life in general, you know, I do forget about CFS. And I'm so grateful to come and see you again, because I tell you, after even having this conversation today and re-inhabiting this emotional space of my illness, I know I'm going to pick up my kids again today and just be like, so thankful I have them.
Wow. You know?
'Cause just the stresses of the immediate thing just pull me away from that remembrance, you know,
like, yeah.
These children are a gift. So I know. Anyway, I'm just grateful to talk to you, because I feel like it's just another moment where I remember again just like how lucky I am. So,
well, I mean, I can't imagine how that impacts you as a father. And I know that it is for the good. And the fact that you think of your children as a gift means that you must be an amazing father. And the fact that you can even be a father.
I yelled at them really bad yesterday morning, so I'm not a perfect dad.
Well, the fact that, you know, you can even have kids is incredible. Because, like, I just got engaged a month ago. We're talking about having kids.
Hey, congratulations, Jesse. Thank good you. For you, man. Yeah. Good gift. Yeah.
And you know, we were talking about, like, can we even stay together because I was so sick? And now we're talking about having kids. So, and that's the thing where, like, life is not linear, and you really do not know what is coming next.
Yeah.
And chronic illness, you know, can make it feel like your life is over. I think you and I both experienced those moments of like, life is over.
Oh yeah, many times. You know, the other thing I was thinking about from your episode where you talked about your illness, sorry, I'm going to talk about you again real quick, is how your partner Andy said, Jesse, do you know how hard you had to work to find your diagnosis? Like, you had an atypical presentation of something that is rare.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But what she was saying was just like, hard work can make a difference. And of course, I love so much of your show is making space for the grief of chronic illness and for some people, they're just going to be stuck in that illness the rest of their life. Not emotionally, they can find joy in what you've mentioned, but man, other people, though, it's surprising how certain headway can be made if there's a patient, consistent approach towards finding some sort of solution or some sort of tools that can help. And I think your testimony is just an incredible reminder of that.
Thank you. That means a lot, for sure. And, you know, I'm still in this place where I very much do have a chronic illness, and it's always over my shoulder.
Right.
And, you know, when we started talking today and you were talking about how for 5 years on LDN, it was always over your shoulder, just getting less and less. You'd try a little bit of sugar, you'd flare up. I'm still there. You know, if I cheat on my diet at all, I flare up. If I exercise too much, I flare up. It's just constant, like, trying to avoid flare-ups. So I'm doing so much better, but this thing is, like, It's like a cloud that follows me around and rains on me sometimes. But you like broke out of that, which is so interesting to me. Like that cloud has dissipated. You did mention there's a couple of little things. What are those little things that are still happening?
It's the weirdest thing. Okay. I can't have garlic or onion anymore, even if I cook it. I don't think I'm ever going to have that again. Although, you know what? I couldn't have guacamole and I just was able to have that 6 months ago. So maybe, you know, 10 years from now, I can have onion and garlic again. But the big one is I cannot have salt after 4 p.m.
So, how do you even figure that out?
Well, I mean, certain days I would have these horrible dreams and terrible sleep quality. Not horrible dreams like being devoured by a monster, but like just like, you know, constant dreaming, non-sleeping, non-resting sleep. And then other nights I would have really great sleep. And over trial and error, I said, I wonder if this is connected to sugar or to salt before bed. And so now I just cut out all salt after 4 o'clock and remarkably better sleep for me. So go figure, you know, crazy ass chronic illness strikes again, you know, so I don't know, whatever. Yeah. I don't understand it. I just know if I avoid salt, you know, maybe I should do some more research on this, but.
If it works, it works. And who cares why? Yeah. And you're obviously like very in tune with your body and in tune with what you're putting into your body and are able to sort of parse through the information you're getting from your body about what you're putting into your body, which is really, really tough. Like I thought I was doing a good job of that and I was not, you know, when I got diagnosed and went on a low histamine diet, which no one lucks into a low histamine diet, you know, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that histamine grew in food. So there was no way for me to sort of guess into that. Yep. But now that I'm doing it, it's like such a big deal. And if I get sick, I can sort of trace back, well, what did I eat? Was there histamine in that? And usually find an answer. And I also have to avoid sugar and I have to avoid alcohol. And socially, those things are tough. You know, someone baked a pie and they want you to eat it, but you can't, you know?
It's such an interesting part of your story where you had a flare up at once you started eating healthy in life. You're like, I'm going to eat more fermented foods and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden that's when your illness crashed down. If you would have just stuck with like garbage fast food, you would have, you know?
Yeah. Frozen burritos, you know? Frozen burritos, ramen, all the stuff I ate in college. Although, you know, once my body hit critical mass, I think that had a lot to do with it. Is like I was just eating histamine my whole life, and my body just hit a point where it's like, you know what? We're done, and you can't have any more. And you just got to go through the process of figuring it out.
Wow.
So what does it feel like to have that cloud dissipate? You know, you've got this thing over your shoulder. I assume that in the first 5 years being on LDN, your worry that you're going to backslide must have been pretty intense. And that's where I'm at now. Like I'm a year in. That fear, the anxiety of backsliding is very intense. Every time I flare up, it's like really hard to keep my brain out of the linear pathway of like, you know, like what were we talking about with aging? It's like, okay, I flared up. That means I'm getting worse. That's not true. You know, it's like I had an exposure or some trigger that flared me up and I will recover. I can lean on my medication and it will help. And that's been true 100% of the time. It keeps working. And slowly, I'm trying to let go of that anxiety that it's going to stop working. But then for you, you've gone the step beyond. You know, you've gone that step beyond to where now it's gone. It's been excised from your body and from your life. And you can move on in a free way as a free man, free from chronic illness. Yep. How does that change things for you?
The first thing that I realized I did was put it behind me as far as I could. It was like a bad breakup. I'm like, I never want to see you again. You know? I wish that I was one of these, because it's so funny. I really consider myself to be one of these emotionally intelligent, you know, postmodern kind of what, you know, therapy loving people. But then, the moment I got better and I could get away from this illness, I really didn't want to be around it at all. And on some level, I wanted to ignore it as much as I can. So again, this is why it's good for me to talk to you, because there's no negative symptom of engaging the memory of my illness. There's just the work involved in that, you know. I went through some sort of therapeutic stuff about a month or two ago, and I was crying again about all these, I've got all this trauma in my history, and if I engage it, it just causes me to weep because it was just so terrifying. So I know that it's this huge monster in my story, but yeah, I don't live with any fear of relapse at this point. I don't live with anything over my shoulder. It certainly has created, again, we've talked about this, like a heart space. So if I engage somebody who is suicidal, or if somebody who has chronic illness, or somebody who has cancer or whatever, I have just such a sense of connection to them. I think for the last 2 years of my LDN treatment, I still had a sense that if I had a crash, that's the language I used, by the way, it was crash. If I had a crash, then I was worried, like, has the LDN stopped working? Oh, no. And then I would pull out of it, and I'd go back to the upward spiral of recovery. But yeah, I would say that in the last 2 years, I just don't have that anxiety anymore. And it's good. It's really important for me to engage, to talk to people like you, and to remember this stuff, because it is so, the lessons are just so good and so important. But yeah, I won't lie. Like, I just never want to see chronic fatigue syndrome ever again. I just such a painful thing. And I don't know. I have a little bit of a clash in me. On the one side, I want to like integrate it in this emotionally intelligent way, and on the other side, I just never want to engage it, and I never want to see it again. And so I don't really have a strong resolution in that way. I wish I did.
Yeah, that's really fascinating and completely understandable. And you got plenty of time, you know. Maybe someday it will integrate itself. By not engaging with it, you know, something will happen where it sort of weaves its way into your story in a way that you can look back on and feel something different than you feel now. Who knows?
Well, and I will say, I mean, coming and talking to you was such a good thing for me, because I was able to really kind of put it in one spot and have a moment where I've listened to my interview or my talk with you probably 10 times now.
Wow.
And I'm listening to myself talk like, wow, that really happened to me. You know, because it's weird. Like, I almost don't want to admit that happened, you know, and so I listen to it over and over as a way to actualize and make real this thing. It's so the your interaction with me was a really important moment for me to be able to put this in some sort of box and understand it and see it. And I've actually went to your website. Is it majorpain.com?
Majorpain podcast.com. There you go. good question. I should know that.
And I downloaded the MP3 of my episode to just save it, because I was like, this is so important to just have for the rest of my life.
Wow, that's so cool. No one's ever said anything like that about appearing on the show. That really means a lot to me. I mean, you know, this project has brought so much goodness to my life, including helping me to find a diagnosis. It's completely changed my life. And we're kicking off season 4 today. This is the premiere episode of season 4. So there's so much more to come. I have a bunch of episodes already recorded that I'm excited to release. And I don't know, there's just so much to be learned about life from suffering and from chronic illness. And there's so much to be learned about the way that bodies work differently, people being born differently. But everybody has intrinsic value, and all life has value, and everyone's experience has value. And the more experiences that I hear about and am able to absorb and then share through this platform, I just feel like I'm learning so much about what it means to be human in a way that I never knew was possible from hosting a podcast. So very, very exciting. I'm so thrilled to have you back on the show. This has been so much fun. I love talking to you. I love the way that your brain works. Like you say, you're a researcher, and that really comes out in talking to you. You know, you're thoughts on philosophy and the human condition, I can tell, are bouncing around in your head all the time, and it makes you a fascinating person to talk to. Simon, thank you so much for coming back on the show and updating us on your story.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Major Pain. I'm Jesse Mercury, your host and the producer of this podcast. Artwork by Egg Salad Salad. Our theme music is the song Time Machine from my sci-fi synth-pop album, available at jessemercury.bandcamp.com. Send your thoughts or questions to our email address, majorpainpodcast@gmail.com. You can also use that address to find us on PayPal. Tips are greatly appreciated. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the podcast platform of your choice. Find more information about this show or leave a comment on any episode at our website, majorpainpodcast.com. Major Pain is supported by listeners on Patreon. Thank you to our $2 per month supporters, our $7 per month patrons Naomi Adele Smith, Sunny Roberts, Laura Stevens, Kelsey Madsen, All Around Foundation Waterproofing, Alexandria Henderson, Justin Minnick, Heather Muncy, and Robert, and our $25 per month producers Steve Kavanaugh, Chris Fowler, Trish O'Brien, and Hipster Leia. Learn how you can support the show while receiving special recognition, gifts, and monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/majorpainpodcast.